Today's broadcast is being brought to you by Blacken Studios. To learn more about Blacken Studios, please visit them at blackenstudios.com or visit them on their Facebook page, Blacken Studios. Today's broadcast is also being brought to you by Perry Publishing and Broadcasting. To learn more about Perry Publishing and Broadcasting, please visit their website at perrypublishingandbroadcasting.net. The opinions of the One Mic, One Voice show do not reflect the views of Blacken Studios or Perry Publishing and Broadcasting. Thank you for downloading the One Mic, One Voice show. Welcome to the One Mic, One Voice show, building the collective conscious, a show that is created to give space where your voice, ideas, and informed opinions can be heard, appreciated, and debated. I'm your co-host, Michael Eric Owens, and I'm in the studio with
your other co-host, DT.
DT is in the studio. Man, hey, listen, this past weekend, we had a blast.
Oh, man, we had a lot of fun. You guys got to come by the crib.
You know, we put a video up, right? Right, we put a video up, and it's got people are looking at the video.
How many of them were you watching it?
I watched it several times.
I did too, though. I'm not gonna lie.
I'm gonna tell you why
I felt the fun in the video. Like I, you know, as an outsider looking in, I felt the real spirit of that interaction. It was cool.
Well, I tell you what, the reason why I kept watching it, because I was amazed by how much Richard can give directions.
Oh,
I mean, he is a supervisor, by the way.
He is.
Now, see.
And the more he do this, you know, he build up on that supervisionary persona. Because he got to look after all these podcasts and just be the go-to guy. So he just get used to dishing out directions.
But I tell you what, I had a great time. Man, you have a beautiful home.
I appreciate it.
And for our listeners, you know we've been talking about it. DT just recently bought a house, and we were privileged enough to, you know, he let us stay for a while. But then he was like, you got to go. I was like, really, man? What? I just kicked my shoes off and relaxed. Beautiful home, though.
Appreciate it. Beautiful home, man.
And
I have some more little kickbacks there soon. So.
Oh, yeah. And let me talk about my gift from Africa.
Okay.
I'm going to give a little, you know, a little shot. I got this, I guess you would call it like a, it's like a hand-carved. Mm-hmm. Necklace, like, mm-hmm. you know, but on the end of it, it has a mic. Now that was you.
That's symbolic, huh?
Yeah, that's symbolic. You must have thought about that.
I did.
One actually. Mic,
I mean,
one voice.
I had a lot of choices, and that just spoke to me most about about Michael Eric Owens. So.
No, I appreciate it. Lovely gift. So, matter of fact, I'm wearing it on the video. Well, he say thank you. What Richard say thank you? Oh, okay, Richard is thanking you for his gift because he was looking jealous. By the way, when you came out with mine, did you notice that?
I didn't. I did. But he got something, so you know.
Yeah, he got something.
I mean, so. I know some of my family listening like right now. Like, man, I didn't even get nothing. So right. You should be lucky, Richard.
Right. I mean, hey, we sorry.
I mean,
family.
I can hear the calls coming in now.
Well, we sorry, family. So, hey, you know, wonderful time to be black in Blacken Studio. We just appreciate the great work that Richard's doing. And it's always a pleasure to be with you.
I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be back in the studios. And
We're not alone.
We have a special guest today.
We are not alone. Who do we have in the studio with
us? We got Dr. Paul Ketchum in the building tonight, who is an assistant professor of criminal justice for the University of Oklahoma College of Liberal Studies. Before teaching for CLS, Dr. Ketchum was an assistant professor for the University of Oklahoma Department of Sociology. Dr. Ketchum received his PhD in sociology from Texas A&M University. His research focuses on racial attitudes and the impact of race on the juvenile and criminal justice system. Before pursuing his doctorate, Dr. Ketchum taught middle school and high school in inner city Los Angeles and worked with at-risk juveniles in Texas.
And, you know, I met Dr. Ketchum, and I have to tell this story. He hasn't heard this story, so I'm going to tell him. But welcome to the show.
That's a pretty stout background, too.
Thank you.
That is a very stout.
The man is qualified.
Absolutely. He's qualified to be here. We wouldn't have him on the One Mic, One Voice show if he wasn't qualified, right?
That's right.
But, you know, let me say this. I sit on the Oklahoma Human Rights Advisory Commission. And we gave, we heard testimony about the school-to-prison pipeline.
And Dr. Ketchum was one that testified before that commission. And when I heard him testify, now, I said, number one, he's an expert. Number two, he was passionate. And I thought to myself afterwards, and he will know this, afterwards, I went up to him and said, what to you, Doc? What did I say I needed you to do? Come on my podcast. That was, I said, listen.
Yeah, I mean, no, you grabbed me before I think just as I stood up. Absolutely. Which was cool.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're so excited to have you on the show today. And if you, and
I'm truly honored to be here.
And let me say this, you know, One Mic, One Voice, we have an international audience. So we're just about in every state. We're really in about every continent,
yeah.
And DT was just on the continent of Africa talking to some of our listeners over there.
Beautiful,
you know, so it's great to be talking about this. And when I thought about this show, I thought about education or incarceration, and that idea of what is happening to our kids in the school system. And so talk a little bit about the work that you're doing at the University of Oklahoma, and even beyond that, if you would.
Sure. A couple things. My research area is in something called DMC, Disproportionate Minority Contact, and that's the overrepresentation of non-whites in the juvenile justice system. And along with that, I also do a lot of research on the school-to-prison pipeline. And my argument is that actually the two things are two sides of the same coin. So that's what most of my research is. I teach both criminology, criminal justice, and we're starting a whole new section of courses at OU in our college on diversity. And they're letting me create a whole new group of classes for that. So
we
can kind of tie the two better together and get a lot of our students a little better background in diversity issues.
Yeah, especially what recently the University of Oklahoma had to go through.
I think
that would be a vital necessity for that. So if you could just take a minute, you know, you spent the majority of your career working with at-risk students.
Yeah.
And so what have you, in your opinion, what have you seeing that has remained the same, has changed over time with at-risk students?
The biggest change has been my perception, what I've learned through it. I don't think the kids have changed a whole lot. I first started working with kids as a teacher in Los Angeles Unified School District. And viewers can't see it, but I'm white. White guy from Orange County behind the orange curtain, as they say in Southern California. And there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, here I was, a white guy who grew up pretty privileged teaching in South Central Los Angeles. And I honestly went in there like so many, you know, young people do, thinking I was going to be, you know, missionary syndrome. I'm going to go in there and help everybody. And I got to be honest, I learned more than I did a good job teaching the subject matter, but I learned more. What struck me really early on is that the kids in South Central Los Angeles were really no different than the kids anywhere else. And after leaving there and moving with my wife to Texas to do our PhDs, I worked, taught in a juvenile correctional facility for a while, and worked in a residential treatment, ran a program for a residential treatment facility. And again, you have the, you know, minority overrepresentation in both these situations. Yeah. And the reality is, again, the kids were just no different, which led me to my initial research when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, where I started looking at where the bias was in the juvenile justice system. Was were the kids more criminalistic, or were they just being treated differently? We call those differential treatment. Are they being treated differently, or differential involvement? Are the kids just, for whatever reasons, social forces at play, et cetera, are the kids more criminalistic? And it became obvious really early on, back when I was doing my PhD, that there was a lot of bias in the system, and the bias wasn't being accounted for as we talked about the issues.
And I definitely want to zero in on the fact that the kids are basically the same.
Yeah.
But criminality, as it relates to black and brown, we know that it plays out much differently in society. I mean, what comes to my mind is that these students, talk a little bit about, because you've been in education for a very long time. Talk a little bit about the environment in which these negative influences are seen by affluent communities and struggling communities. What do you see? How do you see environment playing into that?
I've been working, actually, I had a chance just briefly to mention this to you beforehand, but I've been volunteering with here in Oklahoma City, Crooked Oak School District. And we had done some research there and at a number of other schools, and I was intrigued by the school because despite being an urban school, they had kind of everything in play except for the academic end. And I spent the last 6 months there as a participant observation. I've been, you know, volunteering to teach a class there, spending time working with them. And what's happening there is kind of the same thing that was happening in South Central Los Angeles and, you know, schools across the country, where you have frequently even very well-meaning people will go to an urban school, a minority school, and will treat the kids as if they're somehow broken from the start. There's this presumption of inability. And again, sometimes it's purely malicious, but often it's well-meaning, but just terrible stereotyping.
Yeah, yeah.
And the assumption is the kids need special care, special treatment. They don't have the same abilities. They don't have, you know, the same support. They don't have. It's very, very paternalistic. And in fact, Crooked Oak, and we're hoping if this works at Crooked Oak, and we're hoping we get somewhere there, we're hoping to model it for other similar school districts where we can try to change the culture.
Yeah.
And it's mostly the culture of the administration and the teachers. And again, many who really mean to be very helpful, but are instead treating the kids in such a way that the kids feel that they aren't worthy, aren't able, aren't being treated fairly, you know, that somehow that they're treated very, it's, you know, when we talk about microaggressions, these, you know, these are the kinds of things we're talking about, where you have all of these little things flung at them that add up to, you have fewer kids graduating. When they go to college, they're not going to as good a college as they should go to. They aren't being prepared as well as they should be. There are all kinds of excuses made. And at some point, we just need to kind of change the culture, and I think that'll take care of a big chunk of the differences we see in success through education.
Do you think it's a call for just teachers being trained more on cultural diversity or understanding disenfranchised backgrounds?
Part of it is very structural right now. The conventional wisdom states, and I honestly don't have numbers to show if this is true, but my assumption is that is, and if one of your listeners finds differently, please email me. Right. But seriously, but your more experienced teachers tend to go to more affluent school districts where there are more resources available, and even in states where you have pretty similar funding, official funding for the schools, you still get more, you know, supplemental funding, PTA and stuff like that in the wealthier school districts. So they tend to go to these places where they're perceived as being less things to deal with, less problems, et cetera, et cetera. So you end up with, and
easy
I'll use
street.
Again, I'm sorry.
That's an easy street.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, if you're going to be paid too little for a tough job, you know, go to the easier place. Mm-hmm. And so the more experienced teachers, the better teachers, and it's not, of course, universal, but they tend to to gravitate towards those suburban school districts, you know. So
exactly,
you know, you're more like, if you know, if you're a strong teacher and you're going to make about the same, do you go to Norman or Edmond, or do you go to Crooked Oak or Oklahoma City?
Yeah.
So you lose a lot of the experience. You get a lot of Teach for America teachers.
There's
a teacher there, really strong young teacher. Of his cohort of 52 Teach for America teachers 3 years ago, he's in his third year teaching. There's only two of them that are still teaching.
That was a recent article out about Teach for America and some of the changes that someone was suggesting that should happen with that program, because it's not as viable as it used to be. And we're going to go and take a break here for a minute, but I want you to talk a little bit about, DT actually works as a counselor in the school system. So I want you to talk a little bit about what you see, how it relates to discipline and so forth, and we can get into that conversation. But I don't know if you know, today the Oklahoma Supreme Court has ruled that a proposed penny sales tax that would be paid for teachers' pay raises and funds other areas of education in Oklahoma can be placed on the ballot for a statewide election. That's going to be coming up. You did have a group. Now, this is called Petition 403. Which was proposed by a group of educators and business leaders who want a 1 cent sales tax that would generate about $615 million a year to help fund education and teacher pay raises. A conservative think tank opposed to higher taxes had challenged the petition, claiming it violates the requirements that any proposed constitutional amendment pertains to only one subject. Oklahoma is 49th, okay, in teacher pay, as well as paying per student, and it's considered a weak school system. The U.S. poverty rate for children is 23% Oklahoma is 24%. There's actually 223,000 children living in poverty in Oklahoma City. Folks, we got Dr. Ketchum here with us in the studio with me and DT. We will be right back. Don't go anywhere.
This is DT of the One Mic, One Voice podcast. Just want to let you guys know you can go over to iTunes and search us at One Mic, One Voice, and be sure to rate and review our episodes. Let us know about any feedback that you have and what you enjoy about the episodes. Also, you can go over to Stitcher, where you can get the latest and freshest episodes of our podcast streamed directly to your smartphone or iPad. No downloading or syncing. How cool? Real smooth. Also, we'd just like to take the time to thank you for your time and for your energy and for spending time with us as we discuss the historical record of our time.
Welcome back to the One Mic, One Voice show, Building the Collective Conscious. Hey,
we're back.
Great.
Having some great dialogue with Mr. Dr. Ketchum.
Either. Absolutely. Paul.
Mr. Paul.
Paul works.
I can call you Paul?
Of course.
All right.
Was that a high enough?
PK. You know what? I want it to be one of those. Because right now I'm sitting amongst, you know, PhD material. Right now I'm in class. I'm having a study session right now because I'm amongst collegiate scholars. Got Dr. Ketchum here on my right, pursuing a PhD. Mr. Michael Eric Owens. So, man, when I get my PhD, I hope to be a cool doctor like you, that people can call me by my first name, and it's still all good.
Drop the title. Just call me by my first name.
What?
But, yeah. I want to transition a little bit, because our listeners know, DT, you work in the school system, you're a counselor, you see all types of things every day that you're there. Talk a little bit about, because Dr. Ketchum, he touched on this idea of kids being broken, you know, teachers walking in with this frame of mind. Talk a little bit about, have you observed that with
I have, and I've seen teachers to the point where they're explaining their financial situation to students, and as crazy as that may sound, these students are listening. And, this is my teacher. This is somebody I respect and look up to. But at the same time, now I know how much money she makes. And now I put a worth on her because, you know, she's an educator. She's somebody that, you know, is supposed to be, you know, at the top of life. You know, it's like Kareem is having the initiative for the Teachers Appreciation Foundation because teachers are, you know, unappreciated in monetary value and in all other ways. And so what I see in the school is that, you know, because these teachers are, you know, already kind of self-defeated themselves, they have bills, they have children, they have a life, they pass it on to the kids, and the kids don't get encouragement from somebody like that.
Wow.
And so, like, you know, I don't know if it's, like he said, you know, intentional for some and then, you know, kind of innocent for others, but they go into the situation and the child's spirit is already broken, and they meet that with their own broken spirit, and they don't get a positive interaction out of it.
Yeah, the system's a mess. We don't value teachers as we should. We should also train teachers better. We've got so many people that are in an emergency credentials, and I started on an emergency credential myself. Right now it's necessary, but what I'd love to see is at some point high school teachers, some sort of incentive for high school teachers to have in-field master's degrees. Because you're talking about the spirit of the kid, and one of the toughest things for kids is when they're trying to learn more, when they're asking those tough questions about whatever subject matter it is, biology, English, political science, whatever, and the teacher's basically one chapter ahead of them in the textbook, you don't get that great critical thinking interaction going on. If we had teachers, if we paid more and made it worthwhile for people with like master's degrees in field to teach in high schools, I think that would not magically solve all of the problems, but it gets us a step closer.
It takes the education to another level, even on the high school, you know, kind of
platform. Yeah, you have to know a subject. It's not necessarily true in the elementary school level, and maybe not in the middle school level, but in the high school level and clearly beyond for college and university, you need to know the subject area well to teach it well. Just knowing it doesn't make you a good teacher, but those two things are important. You have to learn how to be a good teacher, and you have to know the material.
That brings up a really good point, because now, and I want to talk about this for a little bit, the social media, you know, kind of challenges teachers, because the student is kind of on an equal playing field if that teacher is using, you know, social media and other things like that to gain information. A student could decide, you know, I'm going to go home and study sociology, you know, for a night, and then I'll come back to school tomorrow with something that I can say, you know, I know more than you, you know, because I'm the kid and I've read up on it through the internet. So could you talk about that, or do you see that as an issue?
I've not seen that happening. Only in that, since I've been volunteering over at Crooked Oak, I had dead air there for a second. Everybody looked really panicked. keep talking, even when you're thinking. While I've been back there at Crooked Oak, I've talked with a lot of students. We're doing college prep and actually doing a college class this semester through Rose State. So we're doing kind of this bridge program to get more kids heading towards college, which is just the first step of many parts. But I had a number of different kids make kind of the same comment where they were surprised that I encouraged them to question anything I had to say.
Wow.
They've been taught, don't do that. The teacher is in a position of authority. So you have to, if you ask a question that's uncomfortable for them, you'll just be told not to, and that will be the end of it. And I think that comes back to this idea of having that expertise would make, you know, the critical thinking that much stronger
because
for the
kids. Because you come at it from all sides, not
just
the, you know,
kids are inquisitive.
Yeah.
And so if they can ask you pretty much anything on a topic, you know, at least at the high school, you know, anything a high school student would know to ask, and your background is whatever, master's in political science like mine is. My PhD is sociology, but I, you know, as having an advanced degree in political science, I'm pretty well versed in it. And a student asking me any question about it, either I know it or I know how to find the answer or where they can find the answer really quickly. I can also discuss it with him, which is the more important part.
Yeah.
I can explain how that, whatever, how the Electoral College works and why it was put into place beyond what a generalist textbook would tell.
And I think what you're pointing out is the learning in environment, which many of these schools are just not anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, because of the, I mean, the budgets that are being cut.
We had just had a mid-semester cut just a couple of days ago.
Absolutely. And
a bigger cut in the fall.
Absolutely. And then when you talk about teachers, you know, the acceleration of trying to get teachers qualified and getting them even in the classroom because you have this deficit, it's you don't create an environment where you can have that sort of inquisitiveness, you know, where you can spend time doing that sort of thing. Teachers
are
trying
to rush.
Oh, it is so rushed. And then you bring in teachers that are not culturally competent, not racially sensitive. I mean,
and not racially representative
of
the district they're in.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're teaching in a school district that Crooked Oak is 60-70% Latino, you would expect 60-70% of the teachers there to be Latino.
Yeah.
You know, they're 10% or so white. Yeah. So, you know, so you should be in that mix so that the students don't look at, you know, just a few, you know, white adults or you know, whatever the case is, as being the sole role models. Mm-hmm. You need that interaction. You need the role models to cross. You shouldn't have this situation where the kids in a largely minority school district are looking at whites as the sole representative of higher education.
Yeah, of knowledge, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's a problem.
And you see these environments where kids are walking in through metal detectors. Mm-hmm. Police officers are there. Mm-hmm. There's no really black male influence in the schools. So everyone they see doesn't look like them, especially for black and brown boys. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an enormous problem.
Well, and if I can take that a step further, our own research, we did, as you know, we did a study, the basis of my testimony. Mm-hmm. We did a study for the state of Oklahoma through the Office of Juvenile Affairs. And we were looking at minority overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system, the DMC that I was talking about earlier. And we have police data, and we also interviewed a couple hundred police officers and court officials and stuff like that. And then we have self-report data as well from kids. And the police and court data we have is from Tulsa, Oklahoma City, and Lawton. And what we found was that that the overrepresentation is not explained by anything but differential treatment. Mm. We can say across the board that we know that black youth are no more criminalistic than our white youth. Mm. I mean, we know this. We know that Latino youth aren't any more criminalistic. The only group we don't really know, because we don't have a large enough sample size, is Native American youth. But I've been talking with a couple of tribal leaders, and we're trying to get that data as well, because I suspect it's going to be the same thing. The problem is we all assume that black boys especially are much more criminalistic, even though they aren't. Mm-hmm. And then we treat them accordingly throughout.
Absolutely.
So we opened with talking about DMC and the school to prison pipeline, and they're the same thing in that, you know, your police, your school police are treating non-white youth in a much more harsh manner. Mm-hmm. And the teachers at the same rate are looking at them as much less capable or much more problematic. So you have this weird, in fact, I was just talking with the superintendent at Crooked Oak a couple hours before I came up here. You get this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where you beat down the kids by treating them as more criminalistic and as less intellectually capable. And the kids then give up trying really hard. And that reinforces the idea that they're just not as good as the other kids and more problematic. And you get this ongoing cycle where the kids haven't done anything different.
Yeah, yeah. You see this, and we're going to take a break here in a minute, but you see this every day in the school system. You see discipline, and I want to talk about discipline, about how discipline is being applied. Dr. Ketchum just pointed out, which the data says this, so we know this. But I'm curious about who's looking at the data, who's
exactly.
using the
How
data.
The...
I know you, but who's applying the data? I mean, who? I mean, we know it exists, but we still see this trend continuing. And so we're gonna hold up, get your drink, because we know you drinking. Look at Richard over there.
What you got
in that cup? See, he like, look, you can't say that on the line. You need to share. You know, so we gonna take a break. Richard gonna go get a couple of glasses, and we gonna be right back.
Or he can just pass it around.
That's right.
Be sure to like us on our Facebook page, One Mic, One Voice Podcast. Follow all of our content on the OneMicOneVoice.com website, or be sure to email me at dt@OneMicOneVoice.com or Michael Eric Owens at OneMicOneVoice.com. Keep listening.
Welcome back to One Mic, One Voice. You know, we're having such a great conversation here.
Off the mic during the commercial break.
Oh, man. What came up?
We had some discussion about white habitus.
And
Dr. Ketchum was sharing some knowledge about that with us.
Please
carry on.
Yeah,
that?
Share that with our listeners.
Oh, sure. You know, as we were talking about during the break, there's a concept in sociology of habitus that talks about how social structures influence the way people think in society. And there's a guy at a Duke University, Eduardo Bonilla Silva, and he was department chair, and now he's running for president of American Sociological Association. So if you're a member, please vote for him. He brought up this concept long ago. He's most well known for his theory of colorblind racism, and books such as Racism Without Racists and so forth. Mm. And he talks about this idea of white habitus, and white habitus is a very specific version of habitus where white privilege, whiteness influences how we see all aspects of society. So one of his more recent arguments, and I'm making actually the same argument in a couple of papers that I've just had just sent out, this idea that our research, sociological, political science, whatever, but our research is biased by this white habitus. My research on DMC, we have shown that non-white kids, especially blacks and Native Americans, are arrested more often proportionally, are punished more harshly proportionally, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it just never made a lot of sense. And the basis behind all these arguments about black kids and Latino kids and Native
criminals.
American kids being more criminalistic has been, that's what the data shows. And because arrest data and court data is very clean in terms of there's not a lot of interpretation, you know, you were arrested or you weren't.
Yeah.
There's the assumption that it's very accurate. with the advent of video recorders and cell phones and as the technology improves, we're seeing more and more examples of police not telling the truth.
Absolutely.
They have in many cases a
position, a framework that they want to to suggest that may not be as objective.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm saying this with a smile because of the irony. That may not be as objective as we were led to believe, yet we'll still... There's been this long fight within those of us who study DMC where there's one group saying, well, look, the arrest data, the court data says that non-white kids are just more criminalistic. The problem with that is all self-report studies, no matter who's done it, we've done some, everybody, you know, who's done a self-report study, they all show that there's not a big difference in criminality by race.
Yeah.
There's a bit of one by gender. But again, there's just not that big of a difference between kids in different areas.
Yeah, and, you know, when you testified before the Civil Rights Advisory Commission, that's what fascinated me about your research, because I honestly know that people don't know that.
Oh, it was clear from the questions I was being asked. There was a gentleman on the committee who was, I mean, you know, nice guy and honestly, you know, wanted to know, but he kept challenging me, saying, well, I know I've heard of all of these drive-by shootings and all that. You can't tell me that there's not a difference. It's like the numbers, I mean you're talking exceptions, not the general rule.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the media's perception. It's sensationalism.
Yeah.
It's all of these things that, as you say, creep into our consciousness, and but it's not true.
We take statistical outliers and use those as if it was the norm. And that's where white habitus, I mean, when we look at, I taught in Watts. We had kids that were gang members, we had problems, stuff like that, but almost all the kids were just good kids. They were just very, I mean, anybody I talked to was like, oh, they must all be, you know, terrible, tough
thugs.
No, they weren't.
Really, it's really easy for us to generalize, though. You know, we use words like all and, you know, everybody. And it makes it a lot easier to do it that way, because it's a lot harder to take the time and really look at what's happening and make a real assumption or a clear conclusion about what you see.
Yeah. Well, we love the stories. You know, these are the stories that a sociologist long ago suggested that crime is necessary in any society as a means to bring everybody else together. You have to have a them, PhD, no, really. You have to have a them in order to have an us.
Yeah.
And so we need people who break the norms of society to reinforce the rest. I think that's what these stories are being used for. It's not a good thing, don't get me wrong, but it's sociologically, white America uses statistical anomalies from black America as an example of normative black America, and it just isn't.
And but would you agree that this is used to maintain the status quo in a system that is designed to privilege one over the other?
Oh, absolutely.
Without this narrative, then, because if we ever accept the data that you're presenting and embrace it and do something about it, then we are acknowledging that all of this stuff that's keeping us in this privileged position is basically, see, I almost said something. You beeped him out pretty good the last time. See, I almost said something, but see, I thought about Richard real good with that button, folks. So I'm not going to even go there.
wait till I get a little worked up. He's going to be holding that button a lot.
But it is, right? It's all bogus, right? All of it. But you know, I just want to just get your opinion on what happened in South Carolina with that police officer that grabbed that girl and just slung her
and
across
the desk.
With the desk.
I know basically what you know is available to the general public. I don't have any great special insight on it, but there's this tendency, and I want to be careful not to stereotype police any more than we should stereotype blacks or whites or any other group.
Exactly.
They're good officers, they're bad officers, and there are some that are at one moment good and another moment a jerk. You almost had to bleep me. You know, you get, I mean, the same person could be good in some aspects and bad in the other, but there is this, the culture in many departments, and this isn't universal either, but in many departments has become much more belligerent, more militaristic. And we know from research, there's one of the real big dogs, Philip Goff out at UCLA in Los Angeles, who's in the psychology department there. He's the one, you've heard about the studies perhaps where they show that officers are more likely to shoot at black, in practice situations, than blacks than whites, and see black kids as older.
Absolutely.
And this is the kind of work that Goff does out there. So we have all of these things at play. So we've got this idea where we've otherized minorities, and we've become more of a more militaristic, more bullying with our police. So there's this. One of the regional police departments here, and I won't say which one because I was talking with the officer, but they weren't, it was nothing on the record, but they were talking about how there was some school type assignments, and the big question from all of the officers was, well, what do we do if the kids are showing us disrespect? Can't we just, and not getting the point where your job isn't about getting respect.
Exactly.
And this was an officer who was telling me about this.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, and I don't think, I mean, I don't know what officers were involved or whatever, but I don't think it was necessarily one of those, you know, we overt where they were thinking it through being, I want to be a jerk, but their job isn't to be liked.
Oh, you know, I may be in the minority. I know I'm in a minority because I look at myself every morning in the mirror and I'm black. So I realize I'm in the minority, right? Every day, right? But I might be in the more minority on this one. I don't believe we should have police officers in schools, period.
Oh, I'm total agreement. Period. Absolutely. We should not, and this gets to the school-to-prison pipeline that we started talking about. When we start making stupid kid behavior officially punished, when we start bringing in the police to deal with fights, with arguments, with hair pulling, with kicking. I mean, and these are things that should be disciplined, but they should be disciplined within the school.
Oh, absolutely.
And the problem is once you get on the juvenile court's radar screen, they will treat you more harshly every time thereafter. So it would still be a problem if all school districts did it the same way. If in Edmond or Nichols Hills or Norman or whatever, Beverly Hills, if there was a fight and they arrested the kids, you've got a problem there.
Yes.
But when we're doing it more in the minority schools, in the poorer schools, then you've got differential treatment. You're treating the kids, you're punishing them much more severely for the same behavior that would be punished but in-house.
So the data is telling us that black and brown kids, for the same offense, okay, or the same lack of following what the teacher said in the classroom, is being punished more severely and more often than their white counterpart.
Yes. And that they're also not doing stupid any more often than the white kids are. They all are, I mean, kids are kids. You know, you can find some really problem kids, but you can find them in any group. Kids do stupid things because, I don't know, they're kids.
Some kids are just easier at hiding it, too, than others are.
Well, you bring in other things like in minority communities, there's less private space to do stupid. Whereas in an affluent suburban neighborhood, you know, you can do the same stupid stuff, but if you're doing it behind a privacy fence, you're not as likely to have a police officer stop you for that.
I believe you said that like from experience. some kids hide it better. Did you hide it when you were what?
I probably did.
You
I
did.
Probably did hide it.
Yeah, I mean, because I know that, man, and nobody was catching you.
You know what, man? It was so fun. It's like I was really like a wild kid, like from like 0 to age 4. But when school started, for some reason, I got my act together. Right. Mom, she shut it down. She's like, look, you about to start school. Don't be embarrassing.
Don't let me come up to the school.
Exactly. And that was all I needed.
You're
I was
5
a,
now.
I was a straight right. shooter.
Time to grow up.
Yeah. Exactly. But going back to what we were talking about, you know, I've seen the discipline happen on one extreme where it's like they're bringing in police officers to handle a kindergarten kid who's kicking and screaming in the classroom. And it's like, what image does that send to the kid at that age about law enforcement, you know, and also the kind of, traumatization that could happen, you know, when confronted with a situation like that. And like Dr. Ketchum said, this should be more of a disciplinary issue where teachers or it's all happening and being handled in-house and then calling a police officer down to handle this very minor situation. The thing about, you know, the good thing about where I work at, you know, the police officers make it a point to make it as positive as possible. So they're smiling when they see the kids. They're just trying to, you know, naturally calm them down without it having to be some type of,
I don't want them there.
You know, boot camp.
I understand what you're saying. I'm glad, but I don't want them there.
See, when I taught in Los Angeles, we had some guys that were hired to do that job rather than police officers.
Oh, absolutely.
And they were trained actually pretty well. They were trained to de-escalate situations. Mm-hmm. They were trained to treat the kid in a very respectable manner. And they did a really good job.
Yeah, yeah.
And there just wasn't, I mean, you could have something happen where you'd want to call the police. That's what the police are for.
Absolutely. And then, like, it's getting to the point where parents are having to go out and do research to figure out whether or not the penalties that the school administration give the kids is legal or not. It's like, is it legal for you to send my kid, away or suspend him for 60 days? You know?
Lock him up.
Right.
You know, that's like a prison sentence.
Yeah,
know?
Exactly.
And it's like the similarities and the symbolic, you know, kind of characteristics of each thing, you know, they go so hand in hand that when the kid grows up, it's like, okay, I'm used to this. Mm-hmm. I've been cast away before. I've been locked up before.
Well, I mean, you look at some of these schools, man. I mean, I didn't walk to some of these schools. I had to, you know, I had to almost like I'm going on an airplane, man. I got to, you know, get rid of my watch. I got to do this. I got to do that. I got to go in. I got to sign in. Somebody's got to escort me around. I mean, I'm thinking, this is prison. Mm-hmm. Now, my undergrad was in political science, history, and law, and I clerked for 3 judges.
Wow.
And so I worked in that system. And let me tell you something. There's not a whole lot of difference between locking kids up in the morning when they go to school and have everybody watching them than being in a county jail. Mm-hmm. Okay, trust me. And so this environment that we're creating, I mean, it's crazy,
and
man.
In school detention, it's like solitary confinement.
Exactly.
You know, like in prison, you know, they send you to this place. You don't have anything. You're not doing anything.
It's just preparing you.
Exactly. Yeah. When you go to in-school detention, the teacher not sending you with no work. You're just, you know, on a timeout.
The great irony of in-school detention is we're going to punish your behavior in school for not doing the learning you were supposed to do.
And then we're not
by giving you nothing to do.
Exactly. Like, right. Are you kidding me? Right. And then the teacher don't even come down and check on the kid, you know, just to say, you know, okay, I know we had our little disagreement.
So how does that motivate?
So when the kid goes back to class, he has some spite against the teacher.
Absolutely. How does that motivate?
It doesn't motivate him.
I mean, it doesn't.
And it actually builds more attention as the school year goes on, because obviously if you're having trouble with this kid to the point that you had to send him to in-school detention, you may have some more behavior problems down the line. So, you know, might as well try to connect with the kid and build up some type of trust where you can get to him. Than, you know, battling this battle back and forth between ISD and, you know, your classroom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we need to give kids more free time at school and more electives.
Absolutely.
I'm an academic. Yeah, I mean, I believe in academic rigor, but the kids need to go screw around.
That's and then really the high fun. School kids, you know, they're sitting in office aid all day.
Yeah.
They don't have anything to do. They don't have any class to go to that. You know, like you said, would be extracurricular, help.
Yeah, they need
more.
You know, woodshop class, horticulture class, whatever.
Holistic way.
Yeah.
Listen, we're gonna take a break. We're gonna be right back. Listen, we're gonna close the show out here in a minute, folks. We got to talk about that school to prison pipeline, the effect it's having on families and young kids. We will be right back.
This is Richard Taplin, host of the Black Box Podcast. Wanted to tell you, thanks again for listening to the One Mic, One Voice. Please be sure to check out their Facebook page, One Mic, One Voice Podcast. And while you're on Facebook, go ahead and stop by Blackin Studios. Also, check out our website, blackinstudios.com, to find all the podcasts that record here, including the One Mic, One Voice Show, The Black Box, The Elijah Bailey Show, The Roxy by Design Show, and also the Gamer Stand Podcast. Thanks again for all of your support, and remember, it's Blackin.
Welcome back to the One Mic, One Voice. You know, I'm looking at some other statistics here. 36% of children in Oklahoma are in single-parent family homes. That's 316,000 children. Get this, folks. High school students not graduating on time. Oklahoma is 21% not graduating on time. Children in families where the household head lacks a high school diploma is 14%. Remember, we talked about the poverty rate being 24%. And also children not attending preschool. Get this, not attending preschool, almost 60%, wow. 63,000 children.
Wow.
Now, I didn't make these numbers up. I'm actually reading them. Folks, we got some serious, serious problems. 21% of people are not graduating. And I guarantee you, if we parse that number out to Oklahoma City public schools, black and brown communities, that number's going to even go higher. Mm-hmm. So, Doc, school to prison pipeline. What effect is this having on not only minority communities, but on these kids?
It's part and parcel of what we've been talking about this whole time. The concept of school to prison pipeline is that we've turned schools into these institutions where the most minor infraction gets you in trouble with the police. The police are called in and brought in to deal with stuff that would normally be taken care of in-house, and that record adds up. So we end up with kids who pile up a pretty decent juvenile record for doing the same stupid stuff that I did when I was their age. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The problem is those records make it more difficult for you to go on and do other stuff. Mm-hmm. During the break, we were talking about things like in-school suspension and stuff like that, and all of these ideas where the punishment is to not teach mm-hmm. the kid, to take away from that, to mm-hmm. to suspend a kid for something minor. What you're doing is you're taking the kid out of the learning environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
How is he supposed to learn something? He's not there.
Yeah, it's just it. So the school to prison pipeline is not uniform across racial and mm-hmm. class barriers. We see this in poor schools. We see this in minority schools. And the end result is instead of kids going to college, they're going to prison, hence mm-hmm. the term school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. The kids at Crooked Oak, where I am, the kids are – very few of them have been going on to college historically. Mm-hmm. Very few. And when they do – they go to a smaller school, a local school, a commuter school, which we know has a much lower rate of graduation than do schools where they're in residence at the mm-hmm. school. Mm-hmm. And it's a big miss because individually those kids should have the same opportunities mm-hmm. the kids at the wealthier schools do. They should be – the best kids should be going to Stanford and Harvard and – you know, Rice and all of these absolutely. Great schools. Most of the kids should be shooting for OU or OSU or better.
Mm-hmm.
You'll note I did put OU first there because I know who signs my paychecks.
The loyalty card.
It really is. But it also costs us as a society
mm-hmm.
because mm-hmm. these kids, instead of going to college and contributing to mm-hmm. a mm-hmm. much larger economy, they're costing us mm-hmm. by going mm-hmm. to prison.
Yeah.
So it just, I mean, mm-hmm. at no level does it make sense.
And the private prisons, right, where now it used to cost the state money, but now the state earns money off of you when you go to prison, right?
Well, there's still the weird thing is the private prisons, they usually run a contract where the state has to guarantee X number of prisoners, which is just mind-boggling, and it couldn't be more bass-ackwards if you tried.
Yeah.
Just absolutely ridiculous, because now you're guaranteeing we're going to don't worry, we'll find them.
We'll, exactly.
We will put enough people in your prison to make sure it's profitable for you.
And this is the free world, right?
Yeah.
You know, fourth graders not proficient in reading in Oklahoma is 70%. Mm. Eighth graders not proficient in math is 75%. The national average for fourth graders not proficient in reading is 66%. The national average, the U.S. national average, and eighth graders not proficient in math, 66%. So you see here, Oklahoma's worse.
Yeah.
It's worse. And if kids are not reading proficiently, we know what's going to happen.
Correlation, yep.
What we're finding at Crooked Oak is... Well, a couple things. There's a few kids who have been scoring like on the ACT fairly well. They have a junior there that scored in the 75th percentile, which for them is really impressive and way above everybody else on campus. But most of the juniors and seniors who are taking the ACT aren't scoring high enough to get into OU or OSU. In fact, a lot of them aren't scoring high enough to do co-enrollment at a community college as a senior. And again, this isn't because these kids are any less capable.
Absolutely.
It's because they haven't had the background that requires it.
Yeah.
So we're losing out. We're doing two things at the same time. We're pushing kids that we shouldn't be into lesser careers, into prison, into lives limited by Voc Tech. If you want to work with your hands the rest of your life, that's a cool thing. But every kid deserves the choice of going to a good college or whatever else they want to do. And so we're limiting, especially non-white kids. We're pushing them into that prison pipeline more and more. But we're also on the flip side, even the good kids, we're not giving them a strong enough education to even score very high on standardized test scores. And I don't want to pretend that ACT is a perfect. I mean, there are a lot of problems with it. And in some levels, it's a really great measurement of affluence. But there's something to be said for they should be able to read at that level.
Absolutely.
And the great irony is the kids at Crooked Oak who are scoring high enough to do the stuff are doing it just because on their own, they read a lot.
Yeah.
So they're not scoring high,
but
they're getting enough to go on, but it's only those who are strong readers.
Do you add another method of way to gauge academic promise or, you know, that kid's ability to go on and be something?
I think there's no question about it. Again, I don't really like the ACT or SAT because there are biases built in. But that being said, it's still, there's some, we need to look at how many of these kids are going on to college and how successful they are in college and everything else. We want to make sure a public education should ensure every kid, and I mean, we can say within, you know, those who have the ability to, but basically, you know, that shouldn't change by race or class or gender, that every kid has the option of going to a good college. We need to get to that point, and we need to get to the point where if 70% of the kids at Norman High School are going to college, 70% of Crooked Oak are pretty close to 70%. I mean, I get that there'll be other social forces at play and schools can't offset all of those, but we need to offset some of those other social forces. And I honestly believe, and this is just, I mean, based on the evidence, the data, that the biggest contributor to these social forces that we're having these unequal results is the school culture. I understand there are differences in home life. I understand there are differences in resources, and those matter. But I think the school part, the low expectation of the school, the lesser support, the fewer role models, all play a big role
in how prepared these kids are for for college. I think if we can get our act together in different school districts and in urban school districts and rural school districts and high minority school districts, we can get to the point where most of that is offset.
Let's talk about some takeaways. Let's talk about some, you know, again, we're not going to solve this problem, you know, overnight. But what are some things that our listeners, because we've made them, Dr. Ketchum, I mean, you didn't made them aware. Anybody that walks away from this podcast and says, I don't know what's going on, listen, you need some help. I'm just going to be honest with you, because you have been very thorough. And this problem, you've been very thorough in talking about the data. So I think people are informed. But what takeaways, what can the average person do to make their local school better or to be more conscious of what their child is dealing with in their school system?
The most important part of all of this is kids are the same everywhere. You have the same proportion of outstanding ability and lesser ability and all those in between, no matter what school district you're at. You've got good kids, bad kids, and everything in between, but they're consistent throughout. So the expectations from all of us, of our educators, of our administrators, should be one of our kids, regardless of what school you're at, are being well prepared. We give them the resources. We help out. If you're at if you're listening to this and you live in an affluent district, go to a neighboring one that isn't as affluent and volunteer.
Yeah,
help out.
Absolutely,
they need the help.
Yes,
we need to get more equal treatment across the board, especially of non-white youth. We have to quit playing this game where we make rationalizations up of why to treat others as different. We just have to stop that because it's immoral. It's killing us as a nation. It's killing us. It's just tearing us up.
Yeah.
And it costs us. If you have a conservative, and notice I put it singular, if you have a conservative listening to you, it benefits them as well for you, absolutely. That one conservative. Hey, Bill, I'm talking to you. It behooves, just because I never get to use that word.
Yeah.
It behooves all of us to treat all of these kids equally and give them all the ability, the opportunity to be successful.
Yeah.
We have to quit having lower expectations of urban kids, of rural kids, of non-white kids, of girls.
Yeah.
We have to stop doing that because they all have the same abilities.
Wonderful, wonderful,
beautiful.
You know, I definitely. I mean, that is wisdom that all of us should latch on. Dr. Ketchum, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So much for we're gonna have you back.
Please,
talk about these.
You say when, and I'll be here.
Well, I appreciate it, my co-hosts. You know, we got the Teachers Appreciation Banquet coming up
January
30th, 7 p.m. at the State Capitol. Come on out. It's on the second floor, Rotunda. Again, that's happening. Mark your calendars, February 20th for the Ralph Ellison Gala, which will be at the History Center. Starting at 6 p.m., you can go online and get your tickets at RalphEllisonFoundation.org. And, man, it's been an amazing show, man.
I've learned a lot today.
Oh, man, class was in session.
Definitely class.
Just sitting here just taking notes, man. I'm like, he gonna quiz us on this? I think he was making up a quiz while we were talking.
Yeah, what's okay? Well,
no, that ain't fair. Cause I'm a pass though. Cause I was right. Now, honestly, you ain't got nothing in your hand, bro.
I don't.
There is no quiz. I'm just gonna grab you guys and have you come help me over at Crooked Oak sometime.
Okay, that sounds cool. That sounds great.
Now, man, I wish we had more time to spend with Dr. Ketchum.
Well, we're gonna bring him back.
Yeah, we're definitely gonna bring him back. We got a lot to discuss here.
Absolutely. We just kind of touched on the surface of this, but you know, education is just so important. Mm-hmm. I mean, it plays a pivotal part in our life. It correlates with income, and so it might that's a pretty important thing if you're trying to make a living.
I think that motivates lots of people to get up and do something.
Absolutely, and just the changes that are happening across the country. Again, we thank you, my friend, for being here. And as always, history will speak of us. Somewhere in a distant future, a scribe will reach down deep into the archives of our time. And what will she find? Will she discover that we overcame our differences? Will she find that out of many, we became one? Or will she find that we solved nothing and remain a divided people? Yes, history will speak of us.